Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kawula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Los Angeles, how are you? Dave Jensen joining me in the studio tonight as my special co-host. Is your mic on? You're
hello, like, hello.
You know, you got a mic right behind you, dude.
There it is.
Sneak attack.
Boom.
I'm out.
I was like, what is he doing?
There's no shortage of mics on the
table. You had a little collage of theme songs playing, I heard.
They kind of bled.
You were trying to do a mashup.
I started the one, and then music. The other decided, hey, I'd like to get in on some of that. And that's who nice. Am I to say no?
You're fired, just so you know, dude, for the future. But it's okay. Dude, your sound effects are so... They're so low.
Yeah.
I think you should chuck that thing. Down the toilet. How was your week? I haven't seen you in a couple weeks.
It's been... Yeah, it's
a long flush. It's a long flush.
It's been a long time, yeah.
So, what have you been up to,
man? All the floater's gone. Since last we spoke, Keela and I played our first gig.
I saw that. It was at like a farmer's market or
something? Food and wine festival down in La Jolla.
Awesome.
Classy
dude,
event.
There must have been a lot of white people there.
You're like, I wouldn't know. Don't really notice that.
No. La Jolla is beautiful.
It is.
Super beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that must have been an awesome experience to perform with a girl.
Yeah, it was great. And what was, I mean, and it was awesome just how comfortable we were playing together because we'd never done
it. Well, you better be.
Yeah.
You'd never done it before.
Yeah.
Well, that's a whole different issue.
Now, hey, man, I'm talking about a different kind of performance.
So you guys were rehearsing and...
Yeah.
Were you like nervous before? Because you haven't done a gig in a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah, we rehearsed a lot, and that was really the great thing on the day is we'd planned to rehearse between sound check and going up. We had a couple hours, so the plan was, hey, let's drive back here and we'll practice. After sound check, we looked at each other and were like, yeah, we got it. It's cool. and it was. And we got up and it was just fun and we could just focus on enjoying playing music for people. It was
like,
really good.
Oh my God. I'm nervous. Where do I puke?
You know? Where is it?
You're a very talented dude and it's been a while since I've seen you perform on a stage or in a band or anything like that. And it's like it's long overdue. You should be doing this all the time.
I hope you got
bit by the bug.
I got a little bit of a bite from the bug. So we're looking into doing some open mics and stuff like
you're
that.
You're like, so now we're going to do a European tour. Just Central Europe for now. We're going to be opening for David Hasselhoff. Don't Hasselhoff.
I wish. Speaking of, before we parlay, have you seen Kung Fury?
I've seen the movie, yeah.
The short that came out on YouTube last week?
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
Dude.
I'm missing out.
All the listeners and Nikki need to go watch Kung Fury.
Isn't there a movie called Kung Fury, like a spoof on?
There was Kung Pao.
Oh, that's
Enter
what I'm thinking.
Pain of the
that's
Fist,
that's
the,
what
that
I'm
one.
Thinking of.
Kung Fury just came out last week. It was all Kickstarter funded, and it's the Swedish production company. And it is like this crazy pastiche of 80s action movies.
Did you say pastiche?
I said pastiche. I went for it. It's one of the funniest things I've seen recently, and it just like nails like over the top crazy 80s action.
Kung Fury.
And David Hasselhoff did the theme for the end credits.
That's awesome.
And there he did a music video for the song called Lone Survivor, I think is what it's called. And that's the end credits.
I love
song.
It already.
And
it's already going to be part of my DVD collection.
Yeah. So you've got to watch it. It's 30 minutes for the short and then you've got to watch the David Hasselhoff music video.
That's an extra bonus.
Yeah. It's my new favorite thing in the whole world. You've got to. You'll do yourself a favor. You will thank me.
Okay.
For checking.
Now
this
I know
out.
You're a huge Star Wars fan. Did you see the Star Wars trailer?
Yeah, both of them. Two out thus far.
Wait, I've only seen one.
Okay, there's two. There's one that's
really
yes. There's one.
Where can I find the other one?
I think you probably saw number two.
Don't take me to a dark room. I don't think it's appropriate.
I got it all set up in this van. I'll block out the windows just so it's not dark and you can see the trailer real well.
Yeah, perfect.
There's a teaser that came out. So you probably saw the one that ends with Han saying Chewie, we're home.
Yeah.
That's trailer number two. There's another one that was a lot shorter that was a teaser that came out before
that. Oh, I saw that one.
Okay, yeah.
I saw that one.
Those are the two.
Well, that doesn't really count. I thought you were talking about a whole different like you saw a different side of the trailer.
No, there's a movie. There's a third that's coming, but
really?
I haven't seen that. So far it's the teaser trailer.
So one, you approve, you're two. Excited.
I do.
I think it's going to be ass kicking.
They got Lawrence Kasdan back to write the script.
He did Empire Strikes Back.
He wrote Empire.
Right?
Yeah. He wrote Raiders. He is of that world, and they got a lot of the old vets back from the original trilogy, and Brad Bird doing the sound. They've got John Williams, so they've got the right people at the table to make it happen.
Have you seen that one little YouTube prank where it's an Ewok running? He's running. I think they're probably in Japan or something. He's running, and then he just you just see a stranger. He's just walking right by him, and he puts a lightsaber in his hand, and he starts just yelling gibberish, Ewok gibberish, and he just keeps running. And then, one of the guys is holding the lightsaber, and he's like, what? And then all of a sudden, 30 or 40 stormtroopers round the corner.
That's great.
And then Darth Vader comes out from all of them and just starts pointing at him.
Yeah.
And, dude, every person just runs for their life. You see this moment where they're like, I can do this.
Yeah.
And then they just, fail at being a Jedi. It's pretty awesome.
You have to reach out for the Force.
Well, I mean, if anybody was in that situation, be like, what would you do?
Yeah.
This is my dream. Yeah. This would suck if it's on camera.
This would be horrible. You can't botch this. It's my shot.
I saw Tomorrowland this week.
I have not. I heard.
A lot of people had mixed reviews. I heard mixed reviews, and I went in with a pretty open mind.
I
loved it. Good. I loved it because it's real positive about just, elevating in general,
and
doing things that make you feel connected to create, basically, to make the world a better place a little bit. So, of course, that's Disney's message always. But I liked the special effects, the story, the acting. There were some really cool things about it.
Yeah.
I think it could have been trimmed by 10 minutes, but I thought it was great.
I wanted to, because I read a biography on Walt Disney last year.
And we're all out of time.
Really interesting. But what was really fascinating, and I was curious if the movie goes into this at all, but it was his plans right before he died. His original conception, he died right as they were starting construction to get all the land for Disney World. And his original idea for the Epcot Center wasn't here are all the different worlds represented in a mall. It was going to be an actual city. He was going to build with cutting-edge design and technology.
Wow.
That was going to be this utopia, this beacon to the world. There's going to be the downtown was going to be under a bubble, and all the motorized vehicles would drive beneath the city, and it would be Burning Man, the way it was all concentric circles, set up. And it was called the Experimental Community Population of Tomorrow, which is Epcot. And he was going to have new innovators come and bring their latest technology there for these people to test and live with before it, could go out to the market. But right after he died, and actually, if you go on YouTube, he recorded kind of an introduction of his plan to the world, and it's the last thing he ever videotaped.
Just kidding.
Oh boy!
Actually, that was—I
thought it was interesting.
That was pretty captivating. Honestly, I was I was in it, but I was it was just dead silence.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I was maybe we should leave the room. Anyways, it looks like our special guest is here.
We've got a special guest.
Reuben Paul, why don't you chime in on this wonderful
Reuben
Walt
Paul,
Disney
have you
story?
Read a Walt Disney biography recently?
No, I haven't.
That's all right.
Reuben Paul is one of the best, and I'm not just saying this, he's one of the best stand-up comedians I've seen in a long time. I actually saw him open up for Dane Cook at the Laugh Factory a couple months ago. And you've been doing some incredible things. You've been on like a world tour with Russell Peters. Tell us a little bit about how you got started and what you've been up to and all that good stuff.
Well, first of all, thank you. I appreciate you showing me.
Studio audience loves you.
Thank you.
It's a media darling.
Thank you. I don't even know where to begin, man. I've just been working like crazy, but I started doing stand-up almost 20 years ago. And I was going to school, I was playing ball, I got hurt, always wanted to do stand-up, and that was kind of like the door open for me to go after it after I tore my ACL.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Were you like the funny guy on the team? It's like heckling all the players.
But you know what? When it came to football, like I'm real serious about sports, but yeah, I did clown around, but I think that's just a natural part of my personality. But I wouldn't say I was a non-stop jokester because I was really focused on playing ball. But I was a theater major in college, and I always wanted to do stand-up but just didn't know how to start. And I was the guy, even though my stand-up is not like this at all, but like if you came into the barbershop, if your outfit wasn't together or if anything was wrong with you, I would be the guy to point everything. I used to kill people coming into the barbershop. So my boy was like, yo, man, you be killing everybody in the barbershop. Why don't you go on stage and do that? And I was like, I don't know how to do it or whatever. And then he said, I know a lady who runs a comedy night. And I'm like, for real? He's like, yeah. He's like, I can get you 5 minutes. And I was like, I don't know. I kind of pussied out. And then
you're like, nah.
I was like, nah.
I like the barbershop. That's more my speed.
I'll keep it here. Can we bring people here?
Exactly. This is why I thrive. Yeah. The barbershop.
These are my people.
Yeah. But you know, it you know, deep down inside, it was something that I wanted to do. And then I just started just putting material together. And then he actually told me where to go to watch, because I had never seen live stand up before. So I went to this club in Long Beach, and D.L. Hughley was the host.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember seeing him, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, because I didn't know he existed. This was a whole nother world. Yeah. And I remember seeing him going, damn. Like, the only comics I'd saw were, like, Eddie Murphy and Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor and, you know, the people you saw on TV. And at that time, nobody knew who D.L. was, and I thought he was the funniest human being I'd ever seen in my life.
His stand-up's good.
Yeah, there were a lot of funny people. And I was like, holy shit, there's this whole world of comedy. That's why I always tell people, you know, YouTube is great, and I know that people love watching everything on social media and not leaving the house, but there's no substitute for seeing anybody live.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
You know, go out. If you love comedy, if you really think you love comedy, go out and see live comedy.
And there's nothing more contagious than a lot of people laughing around you.
Absolutely.
It's other, like, electricity going through the crowd.
Yeah.
Where
And another thing that you'll realize is some people that you might love on YouTube, you'll come and see them and go, they're not as funny as I thought they were.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
And then there's some people that you thought weren't as funny, like, holy shit, this guy is fucking incredible.
Yeah.
You know, so I just think...
That's so true.
You know, to go see somebody live, that's the best thing you do. But anyway, so I, saw DL, and what's funny is he made a beeline towards me after the show. It was the weirdest thing. I never met him before. I was with my girlfriend at the time, and he just came up. He's like, hey, man, how'd you enjoy the show? And I was like, I liked it a lot. And then in my mind, I'm going, why is he talking to me out of all the people here?
Yeah.
And then I just said, I was like, hey, man, I kind of cringe now that I look back, but we became friends way since then. But I was thinking to myself, I told him, I was like, hey, man, I'm gonna try this. And he's like, you should, man, you should. And then that was kind of like the end of
That's
it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then he ended up being my mentor for a small time in this business. And I've been fortunate to have great
You ever
mentors.
Told him, like, yo, man, you just came over to me, and he's
oh,
like...
Oh, yeah, he knows. I mean, the story even gets better and creepier. I was, at the time, I was...
we like that. I was in my room, and he just came out of nowhere and asked me if I liked the show again.
So I used to work at Delta Airlines. Uh-huh. I used to work on the ramp. And, you know, there are a lot of old-timers. The people that we call old-timers are the guys who have... been there 20 years plus. They don't lift a bag. They just basically everybody 30 and under is doing all the hard labor. Yeah. All the old timers ain't doing shit. So I had been working there for a while, and I had just started doing stand up. And then one day, one of the old timers comes up. He's like, "Hey man, I think you know my son." And I go, who's your son? And he goes, Daryl. I go, I don't know anybody. He's like, oh, y'all might know him as DL. And I said, DL Hughley is your son? And he's like, yeah. So I run to the break room and I call DL. I was like, dude, I work with your dad. And he's like, you work at Delta? I go, yeah, man, that's my day job. So it was so small.
A whole other connection.
Then it turns out then his wife went to high school with my brother and sister. What? So it was kind of one of those
things. Turns out you guys are like, I think we're brothers, man. Right?
There's this Tyler Durden Fight Club moment. Like, I am D.L. Hughley. I have been the whole time.
But I would say, like, the first year of me doing comedy, he was very – I learned a lot from him.
That's amazing that you had a mentor like that. Well, yeah. Most people don't.
That instantly. Like, that you went to watch it.
Yeah.
Not even to do it that time.
Yeah, I just went to watch, and he just – you know, because – I just think people who love it are attracted to people who love it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I love comedy. I love comedians. Mm-hmm. I love to see people do well, and I love to laugh. Yeah. So,
like Dave loves firemen. I'm just kidding.
Just the calendars.
So, but I've been blessed to have great mentors from, you know, D.L. Hughley to, you know, George Lopez, you know, who I toured with for a while, and who is very helpful, who I've worked with extensively, Jamie Foxx, Cedric the Entertainer.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, and this is not...
These are all heavy hitters.
These are heavy hitters, and this is not name dropping. It's just how blessed and fortunate I am to have crossed paths with these people and have been able to work with them.
It's not about, like, name dropping. It's like they obviously see talent in you, too. You know what I mean? It's kind of like a mirror. Mm-hmm. It's like... You idolize them, or you admire them
work.
And their work, and they obviously see talent in you, and they give you the time to, like, get, you know, into that groove.
Absolutely.
With them. You know,
absolutely,
what I mean?
And it's always weird, you know, as my career has gone on, for some of the guys you look up to call you and ask you your opinion or your advice on something, or hey, what do you think of this?
That's
or,
crazy.
You know, so to be able to collaborate with people on that level, and the whole time I'm thinking is like, I learned all this shit from you guys.
Yeah.
But I do take stand up serious, and I love it. I enjoy it. There's nothing.
You're a purist. That's what's cool about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's nothing better than making people laugh. And I think in the last 5 to 6 years with all the international stuff, I think my act has evolved a lot in terms of really making a choice and deciding the type of comedian I want to be.
Have you read Standing Up by Steve Martin?
Of course.
So that's like the Bible for a lot of comedians.
Born Standing Up.
But
I mean, and there's a great book by Franklin Ajai that's really the Bible for comedians. What's the Franklin Jai's book? I think it's called Stand-Up Comedy, I believe.
Hmm.
It's been so long since I've read it. But Franklin Ajai, who's a brilliant comedian in his own right, who was friends with all the great comedians, basically interviewed all the comedians, you know, and put all the knowledge and wealth in this one book. And I got a chance to meet Franklin. And
that's amazing.
And have him sign the book and literally just sit on the floor at a buddy of mine's house and talk for 2 hours. Yeah. So,
you know, I think it's kind of like, I mean, not to sound cheesy, but I feel like, you know, any artist that, like, kind of wills it, you know what I mean? I think you attract that energy and you attract those opportunities. And, like, if you read that book, obviously you're, like, one step closer to, like, seeking out the truth and who he is. You know what I mean? And things that he can teach you.
Yeah.
So that's remarkable, man. How was that first show that you did? You were just like...
The first show...
Was it a rush? And was it also like, oh, my God, I got to get back to work?
I mean, I tell people this all the time, and I'm not exaggerating one bit. I had an out-of-body experience the first time I ever did stand-up.
Wow.
Meaning I was... you know, is this? I can't even call it deja vu, but I remember being on stage, and the first big laugh I got, like I saw myself on stage, like taking in the laughs. It was
awesome.
The weirdest.
Well, that gave me chills, man. Weirdest, that's awesome.
It was like you're seeing from a camera's perspective.
Yeah, like I was up top watching me perform and thinking to myself, I can't believe they're laughing.
Yeah,
you know, and that was the first time everyone, you know, thank God I didn't bomb the first time I went
right.
on.
Yeah,
but again,
what's like the spark?
Yeah, it's a spark. I mean? But you know, some people always ask, like, what would happen if you'd have bombed the first time? I just think this is something that I was meant to do. That I would have came mm-hmm. back and did it. Because I know a lot of comedians who sucked for a long time and then got great.
Well, I always hear about the timing. Like, I brought up the standing up thing because Steve Martin always says, like, he would be doing stand-up every night. And then even if he took, like, one night off or two nights off and he went up the next night, he would notice a little bit of his timing not being as on.
Comic Insights is the name of the book.
Oh, okay.
Comic Insights by Franklin DeJoy. But yeah, it's timing is a big thing, and I think, you know, confidence is a big thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think when you first start doing stand up, you just want to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I care about. I want to make people laugh, and I did well at that. And then I got to a point of, what do I want to say? What is my comedy about? Am I making a point?
Yeah, or a message, or is like, what's my demographic?
Is my perspective and my voice
exactly
coming through?
You know, are people getting a sense of really who I am and what I'm about? And for me, it just went beyond making people laugh and letting people know what I've been through personally, mm-hmm. knowing that other people have gone through some of the same things.
Right.
So through laughter, you know, you can bring
you.
It bonds you, and then you can bring healing or whatever the situation
is.
It
gives you perspective and distance, and helps you contextualize those experiences.
Absolutely, absolutely. So for mm-hmm. me, you know, people always, one of the questions I ask is like, man, when you perform, you know, because I've literally performed all over the world, from South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Jakarta, Singapore. Mainland, China.
Jakarta, how was the crowd there, dude? pretty awesome. A little different.
I mean, actually, pretty awesome, man. And one thing,
they're pretty receptive, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're receptive, and here's the thing, man. As human beings, like, one thing that you realize when you travel is, like, as different as we are, is we're
all connected.
We're all connected, and we're all the same.
But there are some things culturally that, like, they may not get, like, even a slang.
They
go over their heads.
You
got to
be aware of that. But here's the thing, and when comedians ask me opinions and my advice, and when I first started, I used to be very observational, and I used to have good, funny, original observations, I thought, and like I said, I did pretty well. But at the same time, you know, two people can have the same thought, you know, and we see that a lot in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody was born. There's no other comedian that was born in Carson, California, with two Haitian parents that were missionaries. You know, so as specific as I can get about my story, mm-hmm. the more original I'm going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that you realize, no matter if you're from Jakarta or New York or New Zealand or Japan or Korea, everybody has a mom and dad or a brother or a sister or a boyfriend or a girlfriend. So there's a universal story that you can connect with. So as long as I talk about myself and...
Well, it's a life experience. Yeah. Everybody has some kind of bonding life experience
that connects you all. Yeah. Like, everybody wants to be happy. You think people in Afghanistan and Iraq, they don't love their kids,
right?
You know
right.
what I mean? Like right. they don't want to be happy. They don't want to see their daughter.
What I always think is interesting, and I love when comedians talk about this. It's like everybody has bad days and good days.
Mm-hmm.
So I love when a comedian will talk about sometimes both, or like, you know, just different scenarios that you're like, dude, I have been there. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's like everybody in the room is thinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you said something really interesting, because it's like it is like what you do is you make people laugh, but you bond everybody in the room.
Just
connect everybody together.
There's nothing better in life that I feel than somebody who might feel like they're alone or going through something and they have that moment and go, oh, shit, I thought I was the only one.
Right.
I was kind of cool. You know,
I
had a sister that went to prison. Mm-hmm. And I talk about that on stage. And I remember when I was performing in Shanghai, the promoter was like, I read your interview in the paper. It seemed kind of heavy. And he was a little worried. The show ended up selling out. And mm-hmm. I told him, I go, look, man, I'm not one of these goofy comedians. And I love slapstick comedy, physical comedy. I love, you know what I mean? I love all types of comedy.
Yeah. That was good timing.
That was good. That was good.
But I'm going to tell my story. You know what I mean? So after the show, this white girl comes up to me and she's like, hey, I had a sister that went to prison.
Whoa.
You know, and people know when you have family members.
Like, where's the exit? I'm kidding.
But here's the thing. There's millions of people in prison.
Of course.
Yeah,
and
of course.
They have families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody talks about that because it's always a shameful thing to deal with. Now, thank God my sister turned her life around and she's doing well and she learned from her mistakes. And
no, but the very fact that you can talk about something like that so candidly.
Exactly.
It's therapeutic for people that may be keeping that bottled inside, not talking to anybody about it, happen to go to a comedy club and they're like, it's like
or,
exactly
or something
that
else, even if it doesn't have to be exactly that, but just they can read, like, you're putting it out there. Like you said, and I've heard it said, like, the more specific you are in comedy, the more universal the humor can be.
Absolutely.
Because they get that this is a genuine viewpoint.
And they don't have to know, like, my parents are from Haiti. A lot of people don't even, you know anything about the Haitian culture, but no idea you're Haitian.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, because when I first started doing comedy, I started with some of the Haitian stuff, but it bombed. This is pre-earthquake, and so nobody knew anything about Haiti on the West Coast. You got to understand, I was born and raised in L.A., and there's not a Haitian. It's not like New York or Miami or Boston or in Montreal.
It's not
general things. Mm-hmm. And now that I look back, I'm not saying it did me a disservice because I learned a lot during that, but it just after a while, it was just another funny black guy. Mm-hmm. So this business we know is about branding. Like, what's the difference between this guy and this guy? Yeah, what's going to make you different?
Yeah.
And what makes me different?
It's going to make you the money.
Yeah. It's who I am and that story. And a couple of my close friends used to say, man, how come you don't talk? Like, I would tell them stories. And they're like, why don't you talk about that on stage? I'm like, people don't know anything about it. It's like, yo, dude, explain that shit to them.
Right.
And then you got to understand, I've evolved as a comedian, so now I know how to present it. Before, I was just trying to make people laugh.
I feel like as an artist, like music the same way, and I'm a musician, so like the only way I can relate it is with music. But it's like I think as an artist, you're just like constantly peeling layers, you know, to get to that like pulp, like to get to that nucleus of like the core of why you're doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And as you're doing that, it is empowering. You're also shedding kind of like, you know, you're shedding and gaining insight, but you're shedding kind of baggage, you know, and you're able to kind of like treat yourself a little bit. You're like, okay, I'm going to kind of find my light and also ignite others around me. I think that's the best way I can explain it with myself. It's like as you peel those layers, you find more ways to like ignite people like through music or entertainment or art or whatever it is. So it's, man, it's incredible to hear your perspective because it's like you have a very visionary approach to comedy, whereas most comedians that have come in here, it's totally different. It's just like, okay, let's just let me show you my stuff, and then, you know what I mean? It's like, he's on.
I flew in yesterday. You never notice in airports how when you're walking through.
Nah, man, I just, you know, and don't get me wrong. Like I said, I love all styles.
Sorry, that was for Dave.
I love all styles of comedy. You know what I mean? Like, there's all types of guys that make me laugh that are just silly, make no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But the comedians that I'm attracted to are always been the ones that have had, like, at least some type of social insight or something that had a point to what they were saying. So everything that comes out of my mouth, especially now at this point in my career, I want there to be a point. I want to make people think while they're laughing. Go, I never really thought about it like
never
that.
Never really approached that. Have you listened to much Bill Hicks?
Absolutely.
He's one for me who, like, just great. And I imagine for a lot of people.
Bill Hicks, you know, George Carlin.
Yeah.
You know,
he's one of my favorites.
He's one of the best of all time. Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. Yep. You're talking about somebody who peeling off the layers.
Yeah.
I mean, bared his soul on stage. So if somebody could go on. I mean, think about this. This for a comedian to go on stage and talk about having, you know, gay experiences as a black male, but doing that in the 70s and in the 80s, you know, like that's great to talk about sucking a dick as a man, and but you're not gay, and not perceived as gay, like that's a whole nother level. Well,
wasn't
of
his
transparency. Record,
one of his records, that nigga's crazy. Yeah. That's what that was the name of his record.
I mean, and just some of the best material you ever want to hear.
Yeah.
Now, some people listen to it and go, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize, like, everything that you've heard was stolen from that.
Yeah. Exactly.
So when you hear somebody talking about black people and white people, it's like, heard that, been there, done that. Well, that's the motherfucker who started that.
Yeah. That's the original.
That's the first they be all like.
And no one has still done it as well as him.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree, too.
You know, no one has done it.
Especially crossing that line where it's like, I'm going to make people uncomfortable and also elevate them at the same time without, exactly. without them knowing it. You know, that's the cool thing.
Exactly.
Let's get to one of your clips. Let's play some stuff that is from Ruben Paul. What is this clip? You want to set it up
a little bit? This is just a this is just a clip of I think this is a joke where I wrote it.
Sorry.
I'm never a rim shot. I'll quit comedy before I'm a rim shot. This is just a bit that I wrote, actually. CSI was one of my favorite shows. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of wrote this joke off of watching CSI. And again,
awesome.
When you do observational comedy, this is one of those jokes where you go, a lot of comedians have jokes about CSI.
Yeah.
Like, what can I add to that palette if I choose to do a joke? So I think I came up with an original take.
Cool. Right. Let's hear it.
Let's give it a listen.
How am I supposed to wipe you by now? Because I watch CSI. That scares me. Have you guys watched CSI? Oh, my goodness. I know you do, sir. When white people kill you, they need forensic evidence to find the bodies. See, blacks and Latinos, we tend to leave clues. The police shows up, looks like Pookie did this one. Like, how do you know? He wrote his name on the wall. That's Pookie Johnson? He lives on 103rd and Hoover? His telephone number is 323-658-8988. Motherfucker, I did it, all right? Some donuts. We'll pick this guy up later.
Very nice. You got us giggling in the studio. That's always a good sign.
That's good. And you know what? I don't even do that joke anymore.
You know what's funny is, like, you know, I actually go see a lot of comedy shows. Uh-huh. I love stand-up comedy. It's one of those art forms, like, to me, like, I'm like, I could never do that, but I love it so much because it's, like, so different than music. And it's a release,
and
you know,
just,
for me.
And just so you realize this, as a comedian, a lot of my friends are musicians and writers, and there is a connection between music and comedy.
Oh, yeah. It's timing. I think it's timing.
It's timing, and it's a passion to create something out of nothing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're around, you know, people who write music, and, you know, you go into the studio, and I've been blessed to be in the studio with some of the top artists, and just watch them work, and they're sitting around, and then a beat is on, and then people are fucking humming and looking around and smoking a joint. And you know what I mean? It's like there's a lot going on, and then you know, an hour later, there's a song.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to hear them talk about my process or another comedian's process is one of those things where it's like, wow, it's a mutual respect because I think to be good at what you do, there's a certain level of commitment and honesty and dedication that,
and also admiration for, like, the mediums that are so different that are also connected, you
yes
know what I mean?
Yeah,
because you said it is comedy and music are very connected, but they're so different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like they enhance each other in totally different ways.
Yeah,
but I just love going to see shows. And one thing I noticed, when I saw you perform, you were hosting.
Yes.
Which is one of the hardest things to do for a comedian, I think.
It is, you know, but it's funny. Hosting has gone through a major transition, especially in Los Angeles. I mean, there was a time where the host was the star of the show. Like, the host was usually, if he wasn't the best comic, he was one of the strongest comics because he has to control the whole show, the room. He has to control the room. And what has happened, I think, in L.A., and this is not an absolute, but a lot of times the MC is the weakest comic. He's the newest comic.
Right.
Which really, if you think about it, makes zero sense whatsoever.
Right,
yeah.
Because he's the master of ceremonies.
Yes, yes.
But see, I think club owners were trying to find stage time for people.
I was
going to
hope you
said
master comedians, but that's okay.
You know, I think club owners are looking to get stage time for comedians. Like, oh, you host, you do 5 minutes up front, and then you just bring everybody on. But see, what they don't take into consideration is, what if something happens in the room?
Yeah.
What if a comedian is late?
Yeah.
What if somebody doesn't show up?
Yeah.
Then
how do you handle if someone bombs right before you, how do you pull that energy up to get the next guy? Like,
but see, a lot of times, a lot of these club owners, like, don't just bring the next guy up. Just bring, and it makes for not as good.
There's
of
no
a
flow.
Show.
There's yeah. no flow. Yeah.
So it's like listening to a bunch of singles or listening to an album.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. Great analogy. Yeah. So
well done, Dave.
Thank you.
So when I host the show,
you're hired.
You know,
I got it back.
I don't try to make it about me. I try to make it for the good of the show. So when you say I did a great job, you know, that makes me feel good because I want people to enjoy the show.
And there were some names too. I'm not going to say who outside of Dane Cook, but it's like I saw that show and there were, you know, maybe two or three comics, including yourself, that I was like, those guys are the shit. My girlfriend was with me and I was like, she was saying the same thing. We agree almost identically on comics that we like. And, you know, you had the room, but you also – and this was what I thought was remarkable. Because hosts – you said the role perfectly. Mm-hmm. But usually hosts aren't who you walk away with thinking that guy was super funny. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Oh, thank you.
Like, so – but you were the host and I walked away going, that guy was remarkable. This guy was okay. This guy was all right. This guy was all right. But, dude, I remember your set. I remember, like, the things that you did and I was like – I mean, I've been hounding Ruben. I'm like, you got to do this show, man. You got to do this show. You're so good, man. I got to get you out of here.
I mean, and I'm happy to be here, and I'm, you know, it makes me feel good that you said that. But you got to understand, like, going back to when I started.
Right.
When I went to the show, I saw D.L. Ugly.
Yeah.
He was the MC.
Right.
And by far the strongest comic on the show.
Wow.
But, like, I guess in the 80s, before I started doing comedy, especially in the Boston scene, and then and you take the Boston scene, mainstream white rooms, the MC was the star of the show. And then you go to black rooms, the MC is the star of the show. Like even if you go to Mo Better Mondays at the at the Improv on Monday nights, you know, D-Ray Davis, shout out to D-Ray, my boy. He's the host. But D-Ray is a headliner. But he hosts the show, so he's one of the strongest comics on the show, and the show
is like what you said. Him. It controls the flow.
It controls the flow,
and it's like when the MC is really good.
Yeah,
you're like, okay, every time this guy gets up, and he's up a lot throughout the show.
But here's the hard part.
I'm gonna laugh.
Here's the hard part, and this is why club owners get afraid is if you put the headliner in the hosting position, or when I say headliner, the season, the good comic, or whatever you want to call it, in the hosting position, they're afraid that he's going to do 15 minutes after each guy, then the show is going to go on forever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what I take pride in is I'm able to host a show, do my thing to get my shine, but not making it about me and still have a good flow of the show. So so I'm not making it about Ruben Paul, fuck all the other comedians.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like I'm going to do my little pieces when I need to.
But you did every piece that you did was funny. That's what's not – that's difficult. Like not only as a set if you were to get 20 minutes, but just doing it chopped up. That's the hard thing.
That is,
it's
hard,
like,
to do. That's,
it's like a musician going up and doing a song and then waiting.
Yeah.
And then coming up and doing a song. And it's like you don't get to that – you don't get into that groove as easily. You know what I mean? It's like you have to go up and it's almost like a fresh audience every time.
And to be honest with you, I prefer not to host.
Right.
And the reason why...
Most comedians do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
But the reason why is because how it's perceived and the restrictions that are put on you as a host. So it's like, dude, I've been doing this 20 years. Why am I fucking hosting?
Right.
I mean, if you're not going to let me host the show properly, you know, if... I mean, I've seen some crazy shit happen. I've seen people pass out. I've seen fights break out. So if you're an amateur comedian and the security has just broken up a fight and the room is chaos... Oh, okay. Let's bring up the next guy. You know, where somebody like me.
Oh, he's not coming up well.
Exactly.
You know, I was thinking earlier today.
You know, airplane food, huh? I mean, has anybody ever been through airport security? My God. Hey, how about the guy in the turban? Why don't you stop him? Stop me.
Let's go study first.
You know, so.
Anyhow.
You know, it just helps when you have somebody who's experienced at the hosting position. But until that is, to that perception is changed, or until club owners realize how much more helpful it is to have that, then I'm like, whatever. Every once in a while, I'll host.
We touched upon this real briefly, but I mean, since I love comedians so much, who are some of your biggest influences?
Richard Pryor, George Carlin. George Carlin was a major influence, especially when I go back and look at my older stuff.
You read his books, too?
Yes.
Yeah, he's a bad.
Especially some of my older stuff. His observational stuff is some of the best.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he got... I mean, he was... George Carlin, like, did everything.
Yeah.
You know, not only observation, he was political. And he had, you know what I mean? So he,
philosophy.
Yeah, he had all, I mean.
He left was, quotes that you're, like, still posting on Facebook.
And linguistics and language. Yeah. You know.
George Lopez, especially his early stuff. I think, you know, when I look back, you know, now on this track that I'm on now comedically, and he used to encourage me. But see, George encouraged me in a way where he wouldn't tell me what to do. He just suggested it.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we still talk every once in a while, but he hasn't seen me perform in a while. But I can't wait till we get together and talk comedy because, you know, he went through a major transition in his career. Like, he was very, like, he was almost like Rodney Dangerfield, did one-liners and impressions. He actually used to do a Rodney Dangerfield impression. Huh. And then he talks about this publicly. This famous manager saw him and goes, I think you're really funny, but until you start talking about yourself, nobody's going to care. And that really hit him in his gut. And he went to his hotel room, threw out his whole act, and started writing about his grandmother and all the pain.
Wow.
That, and this what made him George, the George Lopez we know today. So in taking all those situations that he went through, and he became the you know, he became the voice of Latinos in comedy, you know. So for me, just being influenced and seeing that work so successfully, and then me finally getting brave enough to go, all right, let me talk about these things. Now, you know, there's not some huge Haitian population here, but there's a lot of human beings here, and I could connect with them on that, even though I might not have that specific demographic.
Was he like a source of inspiration for you to do that?
Absolutely.
Just kind of like you went through.
He used to just always say to me, he's like, you need to dig deeper, man. You need to dig deeper. You got some funny shit. Because I feel like this. I feel like I've always been funny.
Right.
But there was nothing. I felt I was special. But there was nothing to really separate me
or from, make it yours to you, maybe.
I feel like the stuff that I did was mine. But just like we said before, it was just never anything that separate that made me stand out from anybody else, except maybe how I look, or like, oh, he's a good looking black guy, he's funny, he's clean cut, white people like him. But this, to me, the substance of what I'm talking about and what I wanted to present to the world and to people, I mean, it's awesome when you go to places like China and somebody comes up to you when you get off stage and they have a specific question, especially if they've never seen a black person before, and they have this stigma. They think every black person is from Boys in the Hood, and then they just saw you. Then they just saw you live and up close, like they're fascinated by you.
Yeah.
And then to have that connection and go, yeah, there's different types. Like, I'm an Obama type Negro. You know what I mean? Like, there's all different types.
I like that you said that. Read my card. It has all the information.
You know what I mean? Like, there's educated black people. There's all different types. Like, and I think that's the thing. No matter what race you are, I think society tries to pigeonhole you into, if you're white, you're this. If you're black, you're that. If you're Indian, you're that. And there's no two people are the same. So why would you try to make a whole race the same?
Well, let me ask you this about China. This is totally random. But like a friend of mine, another Indian friend of mine was like, when you go to China, be prepared. Like, people are going to stop you and take pictures.
Absolutely.
100%. It was like you were a celebrity just because you look so different.
Yeah, dude.
You know? So I was shocked by that. Like, strangers would come up and just ask for pictures.
I think I was in Nanjing. And I actually have a picture of it.
God bless you.
I'm just kidding.
I actually have a picture of it, but I was walking, there's some places in China they haven't even seen white people. So if you're walking down, they're going to stop you too.
I would love that.
Yeah.
I'm huge in China.
You know, they're throwing the peace signs up, and they're excited just to see you. So, so they will stop you, especially in the more rural parts of China. Like, if you're in Shanghai, I mean,
it happened there too, though.
But not as often.
Yeah, the rural places. Because
there's a little bit of culture. Like, you're never just going to walk down the street in Shanghai and see 30 black people walking towards
but
you.
But I've never seen a culture that's just like, can I take a picture because you look so different than what we are used to?
Oh, yeah.
Which is cool, you know, but it was just like, wow. I mean, there is the internet, but I guess it's not in China.
It's nothing it's all like blocked. Seeing something.
Sorry.
I mean, you got to understand, there's over a billion of them, you know what I mean? And we're not a part of that. You being Indians are technically Asian, but,
Hey, watch it, man.
You're Asian. So, just kidding. So it's, yeah, they're fascinated by it. You know, anybody who's different, as I think, you know, I'm sure there's some places in the rural South where they don't get many of our kind.
No, that's the way. No, that's the way it is. Pretty much anywhere where there's a dense amount of people that are exactly the same, it's gonna be, you probably have the same effect.
Yeah.
You just did a world tour with Russell Peters. Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the places that you went. How that experience was.
What was great about Russell is I've been blessed enough to not only open for him but to collaborate with him on other projects, and we become really good friends. So. You know, he's always been supportive of me. He was like, yo, I'm doing this world tour. He's done a couple of them. He was like, I want to take you on some of these dates. And unlike a lot of names, he wants me to shine. He wants me to do well. And a lot of
That's
the places,
awesome.
Yeah, a lot of the places that I've gone with him, they've actually brought me back to do my own shows.
That's
which is
cool. That's super
extraordinary
cool.
in its own right. But he, yeah, he took me to South Africa for the first time, Australia, New Zealand, Jakarta. I went to Singapore with him.
Where'd you perform in New Zealand?
Oh, I can't remember.
Were you in North Island or South Island?
We were in Auckland. We went to Auckland.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's the major city.
I thought you meant the actual venue.
The venue.
But some.
No, I ain't gonna ask those details. I ain't gonna go there. Right now.
Some 10,000 seater, 15,000 seaters. Because when you perform at Russell, man, it's like.
He's killing it right now.
Yeah, I mean, he does arenas. You know what I mean? So, like, we just did O2 Arena in London.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, sold out.
That is incredible.
16,000 people, man.
Wow, so, man.
It's given me a lot of, you know, visibility and access to people I would normally never have access to.
Right.
Because the thing that's unique about Russell, his fans aren't necessarily comedy fans. Uh-huh. They're Russell Peter fans.
Right.
So a lot of them... They don't know who Richard Pryor is and Eddie Murphy and all that. They
and
just
a lot of them
Russell.
Are,
he was the
are
one who
immigrants
came.
He was the or one. Ethnic. They,
absolutely.
That's the one thing that I noticed at Russell Peters shows, and I've taken my family, I've taken, you know, friends. There are so many different races in the room.
Like, absolutely.
That, I think, is remarkable, that he can make fun of everybody.
Everybody.
And, like, you know, the show that I saw one show where I got to meet him. He was super cool. And... he literally didn't have anything written down. Like, he didn't have an act. Mm-hmm. He just would ask somebody, oh, where are you from? And then he had, like, his bag of tricks to make fun of the races.
And crowd work you into the ground.
Yeah, but it was awesome. I was like, you know, and he would make fun of, you know, the cultures based on the people, too. Like, you know, you talk to a Jewish guy, like a Hasidic Jew, he'd be like, you going to shave that beard or what? You know, it's just like little things where you're like, oh, my God. Like,
well, the thing
this is crazy.
The thing that makes him unique, and I've even discussed this with him, and sometimes we forget as comedians, and that's why it's always good. Every great comedian has a guy.
Right.
You know what I mean? That kind of reminds you and keeps you on track or helps you. Mm-hmm. And one thing about Russell, he's worldly.
Right.
And he's literally been all over the world, and he probably knows enough about every culture.
Yeah.
On the planet. Like, I mean, sometimes I've been at shows with him and go, oh, where are you from? And Kazakhstan. And he'll fucking have 5 minutes on Kazakhstan. Like,
yeah. Which is
how
crazy.
How did you even know that?
And the details, the accents or whatever.
And he'll have, like, real, not any general stuff. I mean, like, a real experience.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, how in the hell? He's like, oh, man, well, I used to date this girl and her brother was blah, 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 blah. So then there's that connection. Like, me being Haitian and him hanging around me, like, he'll run up on Haitian people and say something like, how the hell did you... What?
Right,
how they,
right.
Wait, are you Haitian? He's like, no, I'm not Haitian. Like, how do you know those words? How do you know that phrase? How do you...
Well, it's like he does the research.
He does the research.
He lives and
he lives it.
He relates to people. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing that I was really interested by. Like, he is a believer in people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And he can see, like... Oh, this is different than my culture. Instead of being afraid of it, he embraces it. And then he makes fun of it.
Yeah. That is interesting to me.
Exactly.
And we learn about this. And
yeah, and then make fun of it, you know. But it's cool. So where all did you go? You went all over, you were telling me.
Yeah, then, and then, you know, he travels with other comedians also. So I've did a couple. I've been to the Middle East with him. I went to Dubai, Oman, Abu Dhabi.
Oman, that's amazing.
oh, boy.
Beirut, went to Beirut with him. Uh-huh.
Bahrain.
Not with him, but I've been to Bahrain on my own.
Bless you.
and then we just did this European tour. We did O2 Arena.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean that. I was trying to swipe.
That was last for 47 minutes.
Sorry, you were saying O2 Arena.
Yeah, we did the O2, and then we went to Denmark. Then
that must have been an unbelievable feeling, the O2 Arena. That's a landmark. Yeah. It's got to be a landmark.
It's like a Carnegie Hall.
I will say, it was one of the greatest moments of my career. Obviously, to perform in front of that many people, but just that was my first time ever playing London.
Wow.
You know, so that was my introduction. And they couldn't have been more receptive and just supportive. I mean, I still get tweets, and, you know, we did that in April.
That's incredible.
So it's kind of cool. I don't take it for granted. Like, when you say, hey, man, I saw you and I remembered you and I've been trying to get you on the show. So anybody who tweets me or sends me an email or anything, like,
that shit really means
something to me. Like, I don't know if I'll ever get to a point where I'm so famous where a compliment or somebody respecting your work doesn't make you feel good and doesn't mean something.
Like, well, I think people get shut off by it. Like, they get just complacent.
Yeah. I mean, people always, they'll come up to me after the show and say, I know you hear this all the time, but we thought you were so funny. Like, I can't hear that enough. Like, right, it motivates me, and that keeps me writing, and it keeps me creating, and it keeps me wanting to talk more and expand more, and, you know.
It helps you know that circle is being completed, too.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Well, real quick, Ruben, where can people find you? I know you talked about your Twitter. Just give us all the websites and spell it out for all of our listeners.
My website is rubenpaul.com. That's RUBENPAUL.com. My Twitter is IamRubenPaul. My Instagram is IamRubenPaul. And you can
keep it consistent.
Yeah. Got to keep it consistent.
So, and you are Ruben Paul.
I am Ruben Paul. That's who I am. And I just got a piece of, I've a couple of great things happening. You know, we're close. I just got contacted by some people in South Africa, and they want me to possibly do a Mandela tribute in South
That's
Africa.
That's amazing.
Which is an extreme honor. To even be asked to do it, and it's going to be a yearly tribute that they're going to do, and
that's heavy.
That's just a very, especially for the, you know, it just makes me feel like the path that I'm taking, and especially the comedy that I'm doing now is resonating, and it's making people laugh, and it's touching people.
Where can people find you in the Northern Hemisphere?
I'm a regular, you know, I'm at the clubs. I mean, you can find me at the Laugh Factory or the Improv or the Store. The Laugh Factory is my home base, usually.
That's the Comedy Store.
I'm sorry.
Every grocery store.
At the Comedy Store or the Laugh Factory. But I will...
going to Pavilions twice a day,
I've been here every week.
I'll be at Ralph's. Ralph's on Ventura. No. I'll be at... this weekend, I'll be at the Laugh Factory in Long Beach Thursday and Saturday, I believe. But I'm in town until July, until we leave to go shoot this movie. So... I'll be all around town, so just go to my website and look me up. And then I will be uploading a lot of current stuff online, some of the stuff that I'm
all the stuff that you did, maybe the O2 Arena show.
So, and then I'm going to be shooting a special, an hour special later on this year.
Awesome.
So
Comedy Central, or
we'll see. We're still
getting it.
Don't give it away, Dave.
All right.
It looks real good, and it's going to be this special is going to be special.
Well, nice. Right on. Ruben Paul, you've been an amazing guest, and thank you for making the time to be on our show.
Yeah,
this is. Ruben Paul.
Yeah.
The studio audience loved it. They interrupted me. Yeah.
There we go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's have an applause off. Yeah. Ruben Paul, check him out at the Laugh Factory in Long Beach. Check him out in the Northern and the Southern Hemisphere. I'm Nicky Carulla.
And I'm David Jensen.
Don't ever say it like that again. We'll see you here again. Wake up, Hollywood.